1, 2, 3.
You're listening to Sports Talk Chicago with your host, John Zagluhl.
John, I am fantastic. Thank you for having me. You got an awesome voice, man, and that was a terrific intro. You're like a pro's pro.
You know, that was the first time somebody ever said that, John. No, you're the first person to ever say anything like that. That's very interesting.
You got it, John. Anything for a fellow Chicago guy.
Well, what a great question.
That's a great question. Nobody's actually asked me that.
I like it. What a great question. I never heard that before.
Chase Utley is what? You're saying he's not a Hall of Fame candidate?
You know, it's funny. You may be the only person that I've heard make that connection.
Thank you, John, for having me. I'm doing great. By the way, you have an outstanding voice. Not sure about your face because I haven't met you, but your voice is great.
You're doing a much better job than I ever did. You've had some heavy hitters guests on too, man, so keep up the good work. But it's good to be with you, and I'm ready to talk sports.
Hello, everybody, and welcome into Sports Talk Chicago. My name's John Zagluhl. Great to have you here. Today's edition of the program, the Bears lost big time to Arizona on Sunday. We'll talk about it in just a moment. Plus, a brand new interview today with Tom Verducci, a senior baseball writer at Sports Illustrated and an analyst at MLB Network. Talk with him about the CBA, current negotiations, what to expect for Major League Baseball following the lockout, so much more. It's a great interview. It comes your way near the midway point of this show. Remember, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at John Z Sports and on Facebook, John Zagluhl. If you want to watch more of this show, search up Sports Talk Chicago on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, SportsTalkChicago.com. I want to start today with this. You know, sometimes all you can do is laugh. When you're so mediocre, when no change is enacted, no change wants to be enacted, what more could you do? When I watched the Bears yesterday, I didn't feel anger, sadness, or worry, or concern. I just laughed. When I saw four interceptions from Andy Dalton, when I saw Cole Kmet cause one of them by himself, when I saw Kyler Murray barely have to throw the football, all I could do was laugh. What more could I do? I'm not Brian Pace. Not Matt Nagy, not Ted Phillips, not a McCaskey. I wish I was. If I was, I'd actually make changes for you. But I'm not. I'm nothing. I'm a guy with a microphone. On radio, on TV, YouTube. That's it. I could sit here and complain. I could talk about how inept the franchise is. At the end of the day, will any change be made? What will be done to improve the organization? Will my words matter? No. Will anybody's words matter? No. If they did, boy, there would have been change a long time ago. This whole franchise would be on a different course. This is the first time in my life I felt nothing. I didn't feel a thing about that loss. We all knew the Bears were going to lose. We did. Arizona is a Super Bowl contender, number one seed in the NFC. I mean, writing was on the wall. We all knew it. Had somebody from Arizona bet me. They wanted to bet me a dollar saying, hey, you think the Bears are going to win? No way I'm taking that bet. Automatic loss of a dollar. I knew it. We all knew it. That should say a lot about this team. Seriously, we all knew they were going to lose. There was no fight, no competition, not even a rah-rah spirit. I hate rah-rah. That's a college thing, but you know what? I would have taken it. I would have accepted it on the situation. That wasn't even there. What's the point of even playing the rest of these games? Why are we doing it? Why is the season continuing for the Bears? I mean, what's going to be gained here? Loss after loss, no effort, poor performance. What's the point? The only bright spot, two bright spots, David Montgomery, Roquan Smith. Roquan Smith is going to be an all-pro. David Montgomery is a hell of a running back. Everybody else sucks. No one's done a thing. Nobody. We have guys hurt, doubtful, i.e. not wanting to play. Justin Fields, your prized rookie quarterback, got hurt because your offensive line can't protect him. Andy Dalton, your backup, threw four picks yesterday. Although I do want to say this, I dedicate my show maybe a bit too much to this one player, but it has to be said. Cole Kmet's a bust. He is. There is nothing that he could do that will convince me otherwise. Cole Kmet's a bust. If you still support Cole Kmet, good for you. I don't even want to argue about it. I don't. You can have your belief, I'll have mine. I can't take watching him anymore. The Bears never get the tight end position right, but they really screwed up this one with this pick. The real shame is, I thought he'd be great. Chicago guy, Notre Dame, thought it was a hell of a fit. Boy, was I wrong. He's a bust. I don't care if he's young. I don't care. Oh, it doesn't work in Matt Nagy's system, bringing a new coach. No, he's a bust. You have to catch the football. I don't care who you are. I don't care what system it is. I don't care who the quarterback is. You have to catch the damn ball. He always drops the football, can't hold on to the football. No, this isn't over-criticizing. This isn't being cruel or mean. It's the truth. He can't hold on to the football. Why the hell are you in the NFL then? Then don't play. Why was he drafted? Catch the ball. That was his fault on that pick. It hit him in the chest, rolled out of his hands, into a defender's hands, picked off. Make the damn catch. This is the stuff that aggravates me and gets me so mad, because these are simple things. We could debate back and forth about the quarterback controversy, Justin Fields, Andy Dalton. We could all agree on this. The simple things. Make the damn catch. What about the headset? Going out of Matt Nagy. Give me a break. Hey, do you think that happened? Adam Hoge said this update. On the last series, Matt Nagy had a walkie-talkie in his hand. Andy Dalton was looking at him while he talked into it in between plays. Sure looked like Nagy was calling plays again. Why does no one cover this? You know, other cities, other teams, the media would be all over this. New York, Adam Gase, all over it. They eviscerated him when he said, oh, I'm not calling plays anymore. And they found out he was. He was still calling plays. They eviscerated him. They killed him. Got rid of him. They fired him. What about here? Why does nobody seem to care? Like that's the last thing in everybody's mind that this coach continues to lie to everybody. This isn't a one-time thing. It's a multiple-time thing. Multiple years. Different quarterbacks. Just another day at the office, right? That headset thing was a joke. I don't believe it for a second. Sorry. I don't have to believe it. And I don't believe it. Matt Nagy said that the Bears' headsets went out for basically the second half. He was forced to relay the play calls from Bill Lazor to Andy Dalton. Please don't tell me you believe that. Please don't tell me you're buying that. Really, so Matt Nagy's headset broke, so you're telling me he had no influence on play calling. He actually sat there and listened to Bill Lazor and ran to Andy Dalton and said, hey, here's what Bill called. And he had no say in anything. If you believe that, then you have no brain. So, let's see. We have a crappy tight end We have a coach who still gets involved despite promising he wouldn't. Backup quarterback in the game. Rookie quarterback hurt. Players quitting on the team. Team's 4-8. Out of the hunt. Who cares? And no one's been fired yet. Yeah, sounds like a great operation to me. Sounds like a hell of an operation. Now sign me up. Suck at your job. Don't get fired. I'll do it then. It's ineptitude. Ineptitude at the highest level to the bottom. That's it. How did you feel after that loss yesterday? Be honest. I wasn't really angry. I wasn't mad. I wasn't sad. I didn't really care. What does that tell you? That should be a big red flag, big warning for the Bears. You know, the game wasn't sold out. There were empty seats. Nobody went to it. People didn't care. People are moving on from the Bears. That should be a big alarm for them. And that's what you got to keep doing. Apply the pressure to the McCaskies. Force them to realize, oh, crap, no one's showing up. Nobody cares anymore. Because nobody does. People have been asking for change for years. For those of you who are new to the channel, all last year, I asked for Pace and Nagy to be fired, and they stayed. They blamed Mitch Trubisky. They blamed the quarterback. They said, we need a new one. Bring in Justin Fields. For all of you saying Justin Fields is talented, why does he have the numbers that he has? Why are the Bears where they are right now? Nobody's going to blame Justin Fields. So what's the explanation? Why are they 4-8? Sure, bad secondary, bad O-line. Horrible play calling. Bad GM. That's the problem here. And nothing's changing. Now, I heard a report last week that the Bears might promote Ryan Pace instead of fire him. Get him out of the picture, but still keep him in the organization. I don't know what to say anymore. I don't know how to respond to that. I just can't take it anymore. Can't take this team, what they do. And what the hell is this? Chris Courage, out of my YouTube community. So if the current offensive plan, we get either the experienced interception king or rookie fumble fingers. Favorite comment of the whole day. That should sum up what's going on with this team. Why were there interceptions? Bad pocket, some bad passes, bad receiving. Why does Justin Fields fumble the ball? Bad pocket, no protection. There are so many issues with this team. I don't like the idea, too, when people say, oh, this is a great opening. Great roster. No, it isn't. Defense is aging. Got a rookie quarterback who needs a lot of help. It's a project. This is not a great destination. It's a project. You're willing to put in the work. Maybe you'll see some results. But it's a project. I just wish there could be some change. We all have voices. We all make them heard. Nothing's happened yet. I sit here on my mic, talk to all of you. A lot of you DM'd me on Twitter, especially yesterday, and said, oh, I can't wait to see what your take is tomorrow. Here's my take. Does my take matter? Does anybody's take matter? Is there going to be change? I could sit here and talk about it all day, but at the end of the day, what's going to change? What change have we all enacted together? Nothing. We've complained. We made our voices heard. Nothing's happened. And look, I get it. Private business, private team, they can do what they want. They don't have to listen to any of us. But they should expect the consequences. Don't listen. Don't expect people to show up and pay money in your stadium. That was a joke yesterday, a joke. The best part is, too, the Cardinals scored 17 points off Bears turnovers. The Bears could have won the game if they played clean football. But instead, we got drops, we got overthrows, we got guys not giving a crap. Here's your answer. Love Rodney Adams. Love the story. Catch the football. Not a fan of Cole Kmet. Think he's a bust. Catch the football. This is what Dalton deals with, and Fields deals with it too. How the hell are you supposed to be a successful quarterback when nobody catches your balls? Got a defense trying their best to do something, and they can't do it. Not when you turn the ball over and give it to the Cardinals at the 20-yard line. Kyler Murray barely passed the football. 11 of 15, 123 yards, 2 touchdowns. It's a cold-weather game. It's your home. Force him to suffer. Nope. Didn't have to do any work. Nothing. 11 of 15, 125 yards. What's that mean? All of his passes, 10-yard passes. Andy Dalton had the longest play of the game, 33 yards. You didn't even challenge Kyler Murray. I don't know what to say. And this team's 4-8. You know, the funny part is, I saw people trolling. Well, the Bears are out of the hunt. Just stop. Real Bears fans don't give a damn if they're in the hunt or not right now. Everybody knows this team sucks. There are very few people who are sitting there actually thinking, oh man, they're out of the hunt. Nobody cares. They suck. I don't want them near the playoffs at this point. I really don't. Let another team in who's a better story and who's done better with their team. Washington, let them in. I'm not concerned about the playoffs. I'm not concerned about them being in the hunt. In the hunt for what? And that graphic should be changed. They're in the hunt, the Bears. They're in the hunt to fire their head coach, fire their GM, bring in somebody new, and develop the quarterback. That's what they should be in the hunt for. Not, oh, they might make the playoffs going under 500 again. You want to be in the hunt for something? How about all that? In the hunt. One of the many travesties by adding an extra playoff spot. You let crappy teams like the Bears stick around. You make it seem like they're good, they're in the hunt. No, they're not. Watch the games. And the national media doesn't care. Watch the games. They're 4-8. Watch how they lost. Watch how they played. Watch what they've done. Nothing. There are so many issues with this team, and there needs to be change. I don't know how it's going to come. As the voices of me, the voices of other people, hasn't worked. Something needs to happen soon. Now! Oh, could we stop, too, with the fake Matt Nagy fired rumors? I heard somebody say today, well, hey, they get blown up by the Packers, he'll get fired. When will you realize it's at the end of the year, regardless? And maybe he won't get fired. We don't know. Stop trying to assume he's going to go. He ain't going anywhere. Yesterday just proved it. Wasn't a blowout loss. Everybody knew the Bears would lose. He's sticking around till January 10th. And I'll be frank, I don't know who should be replacing him. I don't know yet. But at least I know enough to know that he needs to get the hell out. And this team needs to change. Its mentality, its attitude, everything. They're such babies. They really are. They're so scared of good teams. Let's grow up here Make it competitive. I don't care if you lose. Make it competitive at least. Yesterday, the Bears trailed the whole time. They were always down by two possessions. Can you make it competitive, please? Now you got Green Bay coming up. And the Bears are already assuming the worst. That's when you know your team sucks. You can already tell before the game starts who's going to win, how it's going to go. Your team blows. We knew how this game was going to go. We did. That's why I told you. Didn't take that bet, obviously. We knew how it was going to go. And we know on Sunday how this one's going to go against Green Bay. We know. It's going to be a train wreck. That should tell you something. That's not even an X's and O's thing. When you know how your team's going to do before they even play the game. When you could sit back and say, it won't even be competitive. There's a problem. That's Detroit Lions crap. But, as we sit here today, that's Chicago Bears crap, too. More to come here on Sports Talk Chicago. My interview with Tom Verducci comes up next, so stay tuned. Sports Talk Chicago. With Kazik Lowell, and we are back and ready for today's special guest. He's a Fox Sports broadcaster, senior baseball writer at Sports Illustrated, and an MLB Network insider. Please welcome Tom Verducci to the program. Tom, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So, Tom, what's your reaction to the baseball lockout, first off?
Well, it did feel inevitable. You always hold out hope and you want to be optimistic, but I did think it felt inevitable over the course of the last few months because there really hadn't been much progress at all. And even though the CBA ran out, I don't think it was considered a real hard deadline because usually things happen in baseball when there's a real deadline. And I think because there's no games, because players aren't getting paid this time of year, it didn't create the sense of urgency that a lot of us as fans would like to have seen, where they felt like there was pressure to get a deal. So it was a sad day. It felt kind of like the last day of school when it came around, but it was not totally unexpected.
What's the main point of contention right now?
Well, I would say the main point of contention is that the owners are pretty happy with the status quo and they're willing to make tweaks to the system, whereas the players really want major changes to the system. So that, to me, that's where a really big divide is here. For instance, the players want to at least talk about changing three, I consider, pillars of the last few CBAs: free agency, arbitration, and revenue sharing. Now, in the past, we've had strikes over one of those issues, arbitration in particular. So trying to change three of the pillars in one CBA negotiation is going to be really hard, and it's going to take a long time. So, you know, we saw all the money spent right before the deadline came, before the CBA expired, and we're asking ourselves as fans, well, it seems like there's a lot of money going around, but it's really, it's really the distribution of it. Players want teams to be as competitive as they are, which means every year you're trying to win. You're trying to do the best that you can to win, while the owners, this really goes back to sort of the influx of analytics in the game and using data, have, you know, under the influence of presidents and analytics departments, have realized, you know what, it really doesn't make sense to spend money if you're a 72-win team to try to get those incremental wins to get to 75. You know, let's retrench and really build up our farm system so that when we are ready to win, then we'll spend. So that's a big philosophical divide that players want to say in how teams are spending money. And the owners obviously don't want to give in that regard when it comes to revenue sharing.
How do you think this whole thing gets resolved?
Well, to me, the harder deadline, the one that actually puts some pressure here into talks and forcing a compromise, is losing anything on the field. And I would say spring training as well. I mean, obviously, you don't want to lose any regular season games, but if you back it up, spring training has to be minimum of 3 weeks. And so that pushes things to the end of February, early March, where I think that's when you're talking about really having a lot of pressure to get a deal done. So I couldn't tell you where exactly the negotiations will wind up going in terms of where that compromise is. For instance, free agency players want to knock that down from 6 to 5 for certain players. 6 years service time has been there since 1976. That seems like a no-fly zone for the owners. They don't seem to be engaged in that at all. So it's hard to see right now where the final landing point is that there's room for compromise. But I just have to believe that there's so much at stake if there is any kind of a stoppage that takes the game off the field when it's supposed to be on the field. This is very different from the world we lived in 1990 and 95. There's so many more options for fans now. And obviously we're coming off this and still are in the pandemic where we had the shortened season in 2020. So to me, the risk of shutting the game down even for a shorter period of time is far greater than it was in 1990 and 1995.
Tom Berducci here on Sports Talk Chicago. Tom, how different could the game look after this? Like, could we see some rule changes thrown into this CBA too?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I understand as a union, they're fighting for the best economic deal they can. And those issues that we talked about are huge. But when I look at the game as a whole, I think the biggest problem in the game right now and the future of the game is all about the pace of the game. That has to be addressed. I mean, baseball is doing something that is antithetical to what we all live in this really crowded entertainment landscape. And that is baseball is trying to ask people to invest more time and see less action. That's the complete inverse of where everything else in this world is going. That has to be addressed. And I think if you want to see the future of baseball, what it should look like, watch an Arizona Fall League game. They have the pitch clock there. You can give me this same game with all the three true outcomes, a ton of strikeouts. But if you play that game at a quicker pace, and I'll give you a time of game just as an example, although pace is more important. Say it takes 240 instead of 305 to play the exact same game. Baseball is in a much better spot. The game has to move quicker. Now, so far, these issues are being pushed to the side because the labor issues on the economics are just so difficult for them to tackle. They really haven't been able to dive into these things. We've seen some of these things tried in the Arizona Fall League, but there does need to be some agreement with the players to make this game look better. I do think the game will look different next year. How so exactly? Maybe there's, you know, universal DH. There's a lot of talk about that. Expanded playoffs. Maybe there's things that you can tweak the schedule somehow to change some of that. But as far as the product on the field, I'm a big proponent in having a pitch clock. I hope that's in play. You know, there's talk about the shift. I would not mind seeing a governor on shifts. I think the pitch clock, though, is if you gave me one thing to do, that's the magic wand to wave. It's the one thing that's guaranteed to make the game look different immediately. And yeah, players might carp about it for a month or two, but we saw this with the slide rule at second base, the no collisions at home plate. Players adjust. And now we're at a point now where 3/4 of the players in the major leagues have already played with a pitch clock. They've come up through the minor leagues with a pitch clock. We're not asking them to do something they haven't been through before, but they haven't shown on the major league level real appetite for that. But somebody has to be convinced, other than me, because I don't make these decisions, that is the biggest issue in baseball. It's been kicked down the road far too long. It needs to be addressed now.
How do you feel about expanded playoffs?
I'm okay with it. I mean, I think probably the better compromise is going from 5 to 6 or 7 teams. And we probably had too many in 20, but that was a function of the shorter season. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, kind of that best of 3 first round series is kind of interesting to me. I happen to like the 1-game wild card. It creates a lot of pressure on managers. And I love it when managers get nervous and they complain that they're putting their season on the line in 1 game. That makes it more exciting, right? But the best out of 3 is not bad. I mean, as long as you don't add so many extra days in the calendar, because right now you don't need more extra days in the postseason calendar. The inventory of the games is large enough. What people want to see is games that are deciding games, potential deciding games. So best 2 out of 3, you may have the 1 game where it's not deciding, but I kind of like the idea. It's a different world we live in now. Some people still cling to this idea that the best team ought to win the World Series every year. I mean, that hasn't been true since baseball expanded back in the early 60s. This is the world we live in sports, that the postseason is a second season. The best team doesn't always win. It's usually the hottest team and sometimes the luckiest team. So I think it's good. It's good for the players because, listen, the reason they play this game is to get a chance to win that, to wear that ring. And this gives more players a chance for that.
What do you think hurts the game of the new proposals you've seen? Something you don't like?
Well, I'm not sure about moving the mound back, you know, a foot. It doesn't make a really big difference when you think about it percentage wise. But my theory on that is, yeah, I know they talk about velocity and it's gone up a lot, but, and it gives hitters that fraction of a second longer to see the ball, but you're also creating more movement. You know, the breaking pitches move more. And I tell people, as much as we talk about velocity in the game today, it's really spin that is making the game so difficult for hitters. You know, you could take a high velocity fastball, I'm talking 95 and above, and that's still easier to hit for hitters than an average breaking ball, or sometimes even a bad breaking ball. So I'm not sure if that's going to get anything done in terms of getting more balls in play. I don't know how you retrofit all the mounds across the country as well. I'd rather have guys growing up in college and high school with the same mound, so there's no adjustment. You know, some of these rules about a limited pickoffs to first base, I just don't think that works at all. I like the fact, though, they're thinking about these things, and in these petri dishes and the independent ball and AFL, we're starting to see it play out. Some work, some don't. But I would think about the shift and how, what the answer is. I'm not sure whether you have to be on the dirt or even if you just have two people on each side of the base, you can play as deep as you want. I don't have a problem with that because I think that actually shows off the athleticism on the field where now range becomes super important. And I don't know about you, but I get tired of watching guys just absolutely smoke a ball 200 feet from right field and they get thrown out by the second baseman who's playing the rover position. It just doesn't seem fair to me. I think anything we can do that generate a little more offense would really help. I don't think it's going to be a real big impact on the game. I really don't, but it will help, especially against left-handed hitters who are not that fast, where they can flex the defense so deep.
Well, what about the argument that guys could just bunt against the shift? Why does no one bunt against the shift?
That's a great question because we all sit there in the stands and the field is open to us and we can see that. It looks like an easy hit, right? Just do it. The problem is guys can't do it because they can't do it because they don't practice it. And I'm amazed that more players haven't really made that a part of their arsenal. You know, go to spring training, go on a backfield and drop 100 bunts a day. I mean, it is a single waiting to happen. Listen, two outs, base is empty. You have some pop. You shouldn't be bunting. I get that. But there's certain points of the game, especially leading off down by multiple runs, where they're giving you that hit, you should be able to drop it. But guys just, they literally can't do it, a lot of these hitters. So it's like Jim Leland told me a long time ago as a manager, your job is one of the big keys. Don't ask players to do what they can't do. So I wish it was emphasized more by the teams to have these players bunt. That's my biggest reason why I would say most guys don't do it, because they can't do it.
Tom Berducci here on Sports Talk Chicago. Tom, what do you make of the Marcus Stroman signing for the Cubs?
I like it a lot. You know, Marcus has been really durable. When you look at, you know, the health of his arm and elbow, it's the first thing I always look at with pitchers as they get around 29, 30. Super tough competitor. You love the compete factor you see in Marcus Stroman. Doesn't back down, wants the ball in big spots. I think, a really good signing. When you have pitchers like Stroman and Hendricks, though, and in general, the Cubs staff that puts the ball in play, you better have a good defense. And, you know, that's really what the Cubs have to prioritize here. It's sort of like the Cardinals model. You know, the Cardinals are an unbelievable defensive team, and they need to be because their staff is not a strikeout staff. They've kind of zigged when everybody else has zagged, throwing a lot of sinkers. So that's Marcus Stroman. He's going to put the ball on the ground more than half the time. I like the fact that, you know, even if you don't want to qualify him as a number one stuff-wise, he thinks he's a number one, which is a really cool thing that, you know, he wants the ball in big spots. So I like the signing. I got to be honest with you. I didn't see it coming. I'm not sure Jed Hoyer saw it coming, to be honest with you. My analogy was, it's like when you hear a forecast for a big snowstorm, just hearing the forecast, everybody runs out to the hardware store to get some snow shovels and rock salt, right? And they get wiped out of it. I think that's what happened with Jed Hoyer on the starting pitching market. Like, I don't think teams anticipated the run on free agents, especially starting pitchers, but it did happen. And then you realize, wait a second, I got to go to plan B. Even if Jed wasn't thinking about jumping up for Stroman this early in the winter, I think he's almost forced to because everybody was buying snow shovels. You got to get one of your own.
How do you interpret the move? Like, are the Cubs going to be contending this year? Is this just kind of like a depth kind of signing?
Yeah, this comes out of that category of wait and see. I agree. It's tough to read just on the signing in and of itself. You know, listen, I think it's a good enough contract, good enough pitcher. I think it makes sense no matter where a team is on the winning curve. But for a team that lost 91 last year, you do have to consolidate it with other moves. And again, I really look at the defense behind him, and that's going to be super important. You know, listen, if you wanted to play this out to, you know, what the fan would love to see, a guy like Carlos Correa is perfect for the Chicago Cubs. Platinum gold glove defender last year. What I loved about Correa, too, is he's always been a good player, but he's been healthy the last couple of years. And more importantly for me, he reduced his strikeout rate and increased his walk rate to career highs. So you're looking at a guy who's getting better, really invested in making himself better, even though, as I said, he was a good player already. So, you know, listen, that's the top of the market, though. And none of us saw the Cubs shopping at the top of the market. I don't see it happening unless somehow the market just doesn't develop to what Carlos's true value is. But I'll be interested to see where the Cubs go from here in terms of following up the Stroman signing.
How close are they to being contenders again?
That's a really good question. I mean, to me, it looks like it's at least 2 years away. And again, this is going to depend on how quickly they want to reinvest money. We talked about where teams are the winning curve. I'm not sure where the Cubs sort of do that self-analysis to say, you know, for instance, again, Correa, does it make sense now to shorten the timeline? Because you're talking about a guy who's still young. And obviously, no matter what their curve is, he's going to be around the next time the Cubs have a championship caliber team. But I'm not sure if they see it as that quick. I mean, there's a lot of teams now. Not everybody's able to turn these things around quickly. I mean, the Philadelphia Phillies have tried, haven't been able to do it. Now you have the Tigers look like they're making some headway. When we talk about when they're ready to contend again, you know, not everybody does it like the 16 Cubs and the 17 Astros where it's able to turn around as quickly as it did.
More to come with Tom Verducci. In just a moment, stay tuned. This is Sports Talk Chicago. Tom Verducci, still here on Sports Talk Chicago. Tom, a few more questions before we finish out. First off, your Hall of Fame ballot. What's it looking like this year? What are you thinking about?
You know, I haven't even opened the envelope yet. I've tried not to think about it. I mean, obviously, there's the guys who've been on the ballot. I've done all that homework, have my track record. Anybody can look it up and who I vote for and who I don't. But as far as the new guys go, I haven't yet really dove into the numbers. And I like to really set aside like a weekend just to get away from any other responsibilities and really just dive into some of the numbers. I like doing my own things. I'll read other things as well, but it's a difficult ballot. It always is. It seems like it's been difficult now every year for the last decade as we came out of the steroid era. You know, I like to say, though, there's no right and wrong answers. As long as people do their homework and they have a reason for why they're voting, that's what's great about this process where you have 500-plus people voting, especially writers. They're not going to agree on anything. I know that. And that 75% threshold is so high. I think it's become harder. Usually I had a really good feel for how these things were going to turn out. And I got to be honest with you. I think it's harder and harder. Like last year, I thought Curt Schilling was going in. I thought he was getting over the line and he came close, but he didn't. So predicting where it winds up, it's getting harder and harder.
Well, the guys you voted for last year most likely stay on the ballot this year for you?
Yeah, I don't know that I've voted for somebody and then not voted for them. I'd have to think about that, but I don't think about that. I don't think I've done so off the top of my head. Now, I have changed my no's to yeses. I have done that. And again, people say, well, how could that happen? I mean, the guy doesn't have any more wins, doesn't have any more hits. How does his candidacy get better? Well, I'm not going to pretend like I get it perfectly right the first time somebody's on a ballot. You're open to other people's impressions. And yeah, I think sometimes I am convinced the more information I get, kind of reassess people. I'm glad that guys are on the ballot for 10 years and especially glad that we have that 5-year waiting period. Sort of takes the emotion out of it, if you will. But it's funny that with steroids, the emotions still seem to be there for a lot of people.
How do you feel about steroid users in Cooperstown?
Well, for me, I tried to come up with sort of a policy, if you will, that to me most fits what I would do as a journalist. So for me, when it comes to players using steroids, and this would apply to not just the Hall of Fame ballot, but in general, if I was writing a story, I needed some proof that to me stands up to public scrutiny that a person did use steroids. So in other words, people a lot of times back in the day said, you guys in the media were complicit. Well, not really, because you just can't write based on rumor and innuendo, and there were a ton of them, that this guy is on steroids, or that he had hit, you know, 15 more home runs or put on 20 pounds, so he must be on steroids. You know, fans can do that. I get it. But as a journalist, you should have a higher standard than that. So for me, that when I look at the Hall of Fame ballot, if there is proof that the player used steroids, then I won't vote for that player, no matter whether it happened before testing or after testing. Every player who made that decision realized they knew it was not the right decision in a legal sense. They were federally controlled substances, and from a competitive sense, I mean, I think the basic thing you're charged with as an athlete, amateur or professional, is play the game fairly. And steroids created an uneven playing field. And, you know, when I look at a ballot, I always think about some of the players I talked to in the early 2000s who were playing the game clean and felt really disadvantaged. They felt either they had to sacrifice their own moral compass and use steroids just to keep up with someone, or they had to play the game at a disadvantage. So I always remember those players. And so that's been my policy, that I just can't endorse anybody who made that part of their career, whether it was early in their career or later in their career.
How do you feel about David Ortiz? Is his case different than someone like Barry Bonds or Alex Rodriguez?
Yeah, it is different. It's actually different from anything that I've come across, because there has been a report about him failing a supposedly anonymous survey testing in 2003. But the substance was never identified, never confirmed. In fact, both the Players Association and the Commissioner of Baseball went out of their way to exonerate Ortiz as far as that qualifying as a positive test. I don't think there's been anything like that. So it is a different case. You know, I'm going to go back and really rethink this one hard, whether that in fact should be counted as proof positive that David Ortiz used steroids. It's a really interesting question. It's not an easy one, I'll be honest with you, for anybody who, whatever your stand is on steroids, to just say, yeah, David Ortiz is no, or David Ortiz, I don't care. But did David Ortiz use steroids? It's not as black and white as some of the other cases.
Do you think, obviously, with the numbers he has, he should be in, right? Numbers just by the
Yeah, I do. Listen, his numbers as a DH are incredible. I know it's a little harder for DHs to get in, but I also think about the fame aspect of the ballot. David Ortiz changed history. And I said the same thing about Curt Schilling and some of the games that he pitched. Curt Schilling was one of the biggest big game pitchers, at least of our generation, and helped decide championships. And certainly is the case for David Ortiz with all the clutch hits he made in the postseason. Now, you're not going to get into the Hall of Fame just on a few clutch hits in the postseason. You know, David Freese, I love him, but he's not a Hall of Famer. But when you combine that, it's almost like getting extra credit on a high school test. You can get extra credit big time when you change baseball history. And I think guys like Ortiz and Schilling did.
And Tom, before we finish up today, last question. How did it feel to find out that your uncle, Gil Hodges, made the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, that was really cool, because the first person I thought about was Joan Hodges, his widow, who's 95 years old, lives in the same house that they lived in Brooklyn all those years. So you think about, well, no one had ever gotten closer to the Hall of Fame than Gil Hodges without getting in. And for me, it is personal. I mean, my first game was at Yankee Stadium between the Senators and the New York Yankees, because Gil Hodges was manager of the Senators at the time. And I remember going out to the team bus after the game, got the really good access because of Uncle Gil. And I remember looking up at Frank Howard playing on the Senators, and I swore he was as big as the bus, which is pretty close to being true, by the way. And then Gil Hodges gets traded to the Mets, becomes the manager, and my brothers and I all became Mets fans. So, you know, as a kid growing up and seeing the 69 Mets win the World Series, and that's my uncle managing the team. I mean, I loved baseball anyway, but that really hooked me to go through that October and the Miracle Mets and the ride that they were on. So It's been a long time coming. I'm happy to see it. I'm really happy for Jim Cott, my colleague at MLB Network. Happy certainly for Buck O'Neill and Minnie Minoso. You know, and those guys in particular, I thought it was really fascinating that they got in because they're sort of, you know, baseball lifers who gave so much to the game. So you can look at their playing careers. Obviously, they were on the writer's ballot and didn't get in and say they come up short. But when you think about everything they've done for the game, Minnie Minoso, Gil Hodges, and Jim Cott and Buck O'Neill dedicated their lives to baseball and in very accomplished ways, some of the greatest ambassadors that we've known in the game, especially Buck O'Neill. So I'm really happy that the Hall kind of acknowledged that being a Hall of Famer means more than just what your WAR is in your playing career. And, you know, hopefully that opens the door a little wider for some of these people that really are icons and legends in the game of baseball. So again, my first thought, it still is really about Joan Hodges. Just so happy for her and what the family's gone through with so many close calls over the years. I think they had almost given up hope, but, you know, it's just so happy to see for the whole family that it finally came true.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it. Best wishes covering this lockout and with the Hall of Fame ballot. I don't envy your position, but I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thanks so much. This is fun. Thanks.
I talked there with Tom Berducci, and that'll do it for us today. You're on Sports Talk Chicago. Big thank you to Tom Berducci himself, Matt Tubio, WCKG, Jim DeTalbot, Tomorrow Entertainment for making this show a success. Remember, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at John Z Sports and on Facebook at John Zaglul. If you want to watch more of this show, search up Sports Talk Chicago, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and SportsTalkChicago.com. Another great show comes your way tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening. Till then, stay safe. And so long, everyone.
No! No! Where are the turtles?